Well, could you first tell me, Mr. Bisgood, where and when you were born?
Yes, I was born on the 2nd of January 1916, Roehampton in Surrey, a rather late arrival after I had three elder sisters.
And who were your parents?
My father was J.K. Bisgood, who had his own insurance agency, and my mother was Miss O'Connor, and it was a matter of interest. Her sister, Mary D.F. Bisgood, who was the first Bisgood to be on the stock exchange.
Where did they send you to school?
I was two Catholic schools. I went to St. Augustine's in Ramsgate, 1925 to 29, and then I went on. I'd rather wanted to go to Amberforth because my friends were going there, but I went to Downside because the family had associations with Somerset, and I was there 1929 to 1933.
And what happened when you finished school?
Well, that was the time to start looking for jobs. I was then 17. It wasn't a particularly promising time to be looking for jobs. The country was just getting out of the slumps, and when I was at school, I had been promised an interview to Willis Faber, which, through a somewhat serious disagreement between the headmaster and myself, he didn't give me the interview. I didn't expect him necessarily to recommend me, that was his affair, but he had promised me the interview and I didn't have it, so I was without a line to look for. Two other things I'd thought of doing was to become a doctor or become a solicitor, but both of these things would have required money to see me through, and I thought I really needed to get something which would bring an income. Mm-hmm. And it was suggested that I looked at the idea of going on the stock exchange, which I hadn't thought of. I bought a book, which in those days were fairly cheap, I suppose about sixpence on the stock exchange, and went up to the Roehampton Cricket Ground and sat in the sun and read that the stock exchange was a place where people bought what they didn't want and sold what they didn't have. Anyway, despite that, I thought I'd better go and go for an interview, which I did. I suppose with the conceit of youth, I thought that there were reasonably lucky to have me, as I'd had taken higher certificates for 2 years. I was cricket 11 for 2 years, second 15 in rugger, boxing colours and so on. I saw Mr. Bishop and he said, well, I suppose I consider employing you, but you'll realise that you're very little use to yourself and probably no use at all to us. Come up on Monday. I'd only just started my summer holiday, so I thought it was a fair introduction to business life.
Mm. Had you seen much of your uncles who were in the firm in the course of your life at home? Or
Not really. I didn't know them very well, and I think that they just possibly looked upon me as a black sheep for the family in those days.
Mm. Well, Bisgood was the firm you naturally thought about applying for a job to.
That's right, because my father had it was a large family, and the boys had always helped one another, and my father had been of some help at times to the Bisgoods on the stock exchange when they were first beginning. I think that's probably how it started. Mm-hmm. But they had all retired before I went up. Mm-hmm. There.
What can you tell me about the actual history of the firm before you joined it?
Before I joined it, it would obviously be fairly sketchy and not guaranteed accurate, but the first Bisgood to go on the stock exchange was E.F. Bisgood, who was a broker. He'd been a chartered accountant and he'd been in South Africa. When he came back, he went to do the books of a stockbroker, and he was not at all impressed by the intelligence of the stockbroker. And when he realized the profit that the stockbroker had made, he thought, "Oh, I'm in the wrong business. If he can make that sort of money, I can and more." So he set up his own business, and it quite successful. And then he suggested that one of his brothers, Eustace, that was scoped for a jobber to start up on the stock exchange there. There were, of course, other jobbers, but he thought that the stock exchange was a growth industry. And Eustace set up his jobbing business, and after the end of the war, First World War, he brought in one of his brothers who trained as a solicitor, and that was Bertram Bisgood, and he also made a, they became Bisgood brothers, and then they brought into partnership H.G. Bishop, who had been in the firm before, was a very forceful character. Then later on, they brought in Harold Strawn, who had been with a firm called Haddo and Turner. And when I went there, there were Henry Bishop, Harold Strawn, Frank Bishop, Simmons, who was a very good jobber, Louis Bishop, and then before the war, they brought into partnership, before the Second World War, obviously, they brought into partnership Howard Taylor. Well, I think his first claim to fame was he'd bowled Sutcliffe with his first ball in county cricket. And then just before the war, they brought Capra into partnership.
What markets had your uncles been dealing in?
We were mainly English industrials based on the motor car industry, which were sort of famous old names which sadly have disappeared, and Dunlop, of course, which was the, I suppose the Dunlop was to them in those days what Morris became to us in 1936.
Was there anything distinctive about Bisgood Bishop as a jobbing firm when you joined it, or was it fairly typical of the jobbing firms of the period?
I think it was fairly typical of the small and medium ones. Though they were small or to medium, they very often had a niche which they were very much the market, and the markets were more centralized in those days. As the years passed, particularly through mergers or takeovers, people started dealing in many different markets, but in those days the markets were more clearly defined.
And about how big was the actual office itself? You've mentioned the partners. About how many people were employed?
Oh, we must have had, I should think, a short 30. Mm-hmm.
Can you remember the offices at the time that
yes,
you joined?
Yes, I went to Pinner's Hall. It was the first one. It was a nice set of offices, and we used to guess what our bonus might be as to whether we'd gone up two floors or down two floors, depending on how we were doing. But they were very good offices. Then we went later on to Gresham House, which we got at a very reasonable rent because it was about to be pulled down, but the planning permission was held up, so that was very satisfactory. And we ended up in Wood Street, a nice set of offices there.
What were the reasons why you moved from one office to the other?
Usually on the question of a lease, the price being going up violently, or sometimes another firm in the building would want to expand and you were offered reasonable compensation for moving. There were very few firms that really had freeholds in those days.
About how many rooms were you occupying?
The one I went to, we had a main, when I first went there, it was a main office, open plan, and then a short corridor, there was a head partner's room, and then a dealing room. But everything was really in the general office, which was fairly good because it meant the office manager could oversee everything that was happening. Mm.
What actually went on in the dealing room?
The dealing room was one of the things, I suppose, has always been an expensive habit, but it's an essential one to the degree that nearly all dealing was done on the floor of the house. So they went down at 9 o'clock and came back at 3:30, whatever hour after the house had closed. It was therefore used if, supposing there'd been a big issue, new issue, which were allotment letters, which would mean you'd get almost suitcases of stuff coming in. So the office staff dealing with allotment letters would take over the dealing room while the dealers were down in the house. So it's very useful for that. Then after the house closed, the dealers came back and dealt as long as anybody wanted their services.
They do that over the telephone?
They did that over the telephone occasionally, very, very occasionally. If it was a big deal or a particularly tricky one, the broker might come up to the office, or for that matter, he might ring up and say, I'd like to speak to so-and-so and I'd like him to come over to my office. Mm. So you thought, well, probably, obviously something cooking here is not asking me for a test a new type of tea, and so somebody would, or if he'd specified, the chap would go along. That, oddly enough, is how the main bust-up with Bishop and Strawn happened. Harry Bishop was in the war, and Strawn was the head partner. So, a man of ability and great charm, and brokers who obviously had been dealing with him in the war tended to regard him as the person to approach. And after the war, Harry Bishop was determined to make himself again quite clearly the boss. And when a broker asked Hal Strawn to go and see him about a new issue, Harry Bishop said it's quite wrong that he was the head partner and he would go. And I think the broker said he wanted to see Strawn and he didn't want to see anybody else. Now that really finished the situation. I think Strawn, to his credit, wasn't prepared to really test it out. And the two most influential partners then, Howard Taylor and Capper, were prepared to side with Harry Bishop, although Capper was Strawn's cousin. And Strawn thought, well, I won't go down to the other people, I suppose, myself, Len King. We'd been the two senior dealers before the war, and we'd just been made partners in 46. We were members in 46, and he then retired gracefully, which I was very sad in many ways.
Mm. Were there other cases of tensions occurring between partners who'd gone off to the war and came back to their firms and those who'd stayed behind? It seems like a very natural thing that would happen.
I think probably not so much with partners who'd done it. I think probably the dealers, truly had one been a fairly minor cog in peacetime, sort of discipline and respect in offices, I think, was fairly good, provided the leadership was good, and certainly, whatever its faults, Harry Bishop was a distinct leader. After you'd been sort of travelled around various parts of the world and shot and been shot at, you came back with a rather greater feeling of worth, which probably wasn't reciprocated by the senior people because they still looked upon you as the junior people that you had been in 1939, and one came back with 1944. rather different ideas. But I think on the whole, I think most firms sorted themselves out. There were obviously the odd dust-ups and people did move around a bit. But eventually, because it had been, I think it was a very civilized, although people said it was a jungle, I think there were very civilized people in the jungle.
Well, let's go back to 1933 when you joined the firm. What was your first job?
My first job was to make the tea, and I've always felt they never had better tea than when I was there. I was then promoted to addressing envelopes, and then I started to move around to give a hand in the various departments which were split up, which was good because the people, a number of the people who were heads of those departments eventually became partners in the firm, and one also doing that and working on a lot with letters, transfers. I never mastered the contometer, I must admit, being the forerunner of the computer, which I never attempted to master, but at least you knew how the office worked, and later on you knew what you wanted, you could always see that it was done, and it, until the computers came in when it did change, it was very useful to know.
Can you explain what the contometer was, if not exactly how it worked?
Yes, it was. I had been brought up on fractions, vulgar fractions, I think they were called in those days, and the contometer was the thing that worked on decimals, which I didn't understand, and the chap running it explained to me how much easier it was using the decimal system. Basically, it was the working out the valuation for a number of shares and the price at which had been done. I mean, obviously, 100 shares at a pound is fairly simple, but 797 shares at 32 and eightpence farthing on the computer was a split second, tapped out. Whereas with the best will in the world, it would take quite a few minutes to do it through the brain unless you were a genius.
Was this a standard piece of office equipment in all jobbing firms?
I would have thought broking firms too.
And what did you progress to after moving around the different departments in the office?
Then I was lucky. There was vacancy in the house when Howard Taylor was made up to a partner. The capper, I think, had been doing the checking at that time, and so he went in as a blue button, which I'll explain when we come to that. And so I went as the junior checking clerk. This was, again, marvellous experience. You went into the basement, the jobbers sat with the book of bargains open. If you were sitting near another jobber, not too open in case he was looking over your shoulder to see what you'd been doing. And the brokers came up and checked the bargains that they had done. You had your book and you, importantly, you didn't tick it, you initialed it, so that if there was a mistake, that you had checked it wrongly, you couldn't put it off, well, it wasn't my tick, that was your signature on it. And also you made friends there who you would meet later on, is when they went into the house and you went into the house and you progressed on with that. Then there was a chance for another blue button. The capper was made a dealer, and as I was expert probably in nothing of the various departments, where the boss of these various departments had been for some years, I got the chance of going into the house, and that marvellous to feel that first day you went in. It was emphasised very strongly that you were nothing, that members could push you out of the way, kick you if you got in their way, it was your fault, that you could be reported to the committee. There was a chap who was a classic. I regret to say that he was a jobber. I think he must have been very short-sighted, but he was really very rude and unpleasant to Blue Buttons, but I suppose the Blue Buttons brokers were more sedate. Blue Buttons of jobbers were rushing speed to be first to, with a bid or offer of stock. And he would suddenly grab them, hold them up, and ask their name and firm and complain and so on. I think his bark was always worse than his bite, but it certainly was very off-putting. I then looked round. By now I decided that stock exchange was going to be my life and I had to make a success of it. At the various books, the partners had books which were specialised markets. And to my mind, Strawn, who had the motor book, was the obvious chap to attach myself to, because I liked and admired him very much, and B, I felt that I could be more useful there than some of the others would. Some of the others, you could see the market had changed. I'm not saying immediately, but while I was still Blue Button, could see the market had changed, and supposing they had a selling limit, and you felt they really ought to go and bid it because the market was looking good. But 5 minutes after everybody else, they would decide perhaps they ought to do something about it, and you knew it was a waste of time. Obviously, you had to go, but you didn't wait for an answer. Strawn sends you on something. I was in trying to get an answer, an intelligent answer back, and so I became more and more involved in that side. I virtually ran the errands as well as I could for anybody else, but tried to bring back the gen for the motor book. I think it's a matter of interest. Here one might say a word about the waiters. There were various stands where brokers could be called on the floor of the stock exchange, and most of the bigger firms would certainly have people available there, and you would, unless you knew the person you wanted, who was in the office, in which case you'd probably do it by telephone, but you'd go off to the stand, and which was in charge of a waiter, and he would wear his top hat and his blue suit and red cuffs and badge of office, and some of you got on well with them. They were extremely valuable. They would then call out the name of the broker that you wanted. Some people still tended rather to look down on them, not realizing that the one on our stand was a JP, and various other of them were tended as a were in charge of banquets and so on and so forth. And if you've gone on well and treated them nicely, they were extremely good. I won't say that if you were second or third in the queue for a broker and you waited a few seconds, and then if you hadn't come, you wrote out a slip what you wanted to do, that if you got on with them, they would give you your slip as though first the broker, as though you were the first man in. Equally, they'd say, oh, he's just out. You want to say, yes, he's just gone over to Slater's for a drink. So you looked across the road into Slater's, saw the chap you wanted, got your message, either received the information, and came back. As a Blue Button, of course, you couldn't deal. So that when you went to bid for stock, the chap would say, yes, I am the seller of that, and I'll come over and confirm it. And after with the dealer. And after a time, they began to accept that they wouldn't have to go over to confirm it, because we obviously got it right. And I had a very embarrassing experience. As I say, Strawn occasionally used to sort of go out or be having a conversation, and the correct etiquette to say Price was making, my partner was quoting, and because you could say what your partner was quoting, but you couldn't quote it because you weren't entitled to the deal. And so you'd say he's quoting 36 pound or sixpence or whatever the thing might be. And then if the dealer wanted a deal, you then had to get hold of your dealer and sort of say, I suggested you the 6 pound to sixpence that right? And so he would say yes, or give you a penny, halfpenny more, whatever it was. And if the broker said, oh, well, I want to sell 536 bob, fine, and shot off, it was a bit difficult. And I regret to say that I used to occasionally book these bargains without having had it confirmed. Somebody complained about this, and one day to my, I think a member of the committee and the chap who made the complaint, and there was a friend of mine who was a dealer, and he wanted to deal, and my boss was busy with somebody else. He said, well, come on, book the bloody thing. And I said, look, I can't, there's a committee member watching me, really, and they're going to have me sank. So he then sort of went off, and all was well. So I was warned about that, and fortunately, I hadn't done this until very nearly the time when I was due to be authorised, and I hoped to be authorised when I was 21, but I think that my birthday was the 2nd of January, and there happened to be a Sunday, so I was 21 on one day, and then all was well.
So, can you tell me what happened? What was involved in becoming authorised? What did that mean?
Well, then, when you were authorised, it meant that you could deal, and the firm was responsible for your dealing, so that if you did a dud, the firm were lumbered with it. And normally, obviously, you work with your boss, whether you agreed or disagreed with him, he was responsible ultimately, and so if he said we should do this or you should do that, you did it. I think the whole of the time that I dealt with Strawn, there was only one case when he shouted me out, and he was quite absolutely right to do it. We had a divergence of opinion, and he bought some stock, and I was sure it was wrong. And when he was out, I had the chance of taking a small loss on it, which I did. And by the time he came back, fortunately for my skin, the price had dropped a bit. So I told him what I'd done. And he'd had a bullet in the First World War, which had gone just through his temple, which he had a scar there. And you always were to watch that. If it started to throb, you knew there was trouble coming. So I haven't said to anybody else, but I saw this starting to throb. And he really tore me off, as I say, absolutely correctly. I shouldn't have done it. The fact that I was right was, in this case, was immaterial. Mm-hmm. Having said that, he then took me out for a drink.
What were your feelings when you first became an authorised clerk and were able to make bargains and deal on your own?
I think enjoyment. I'm sure that it would be very difficult to have been a jobber unless you actually enjoyed it. You could be a broker, I think, and not particularly enjoyable if the money was right and so on and so forth. But a jobber, you were so involved with it that if you hadn't liked it, and if you liked the people as well, and things were going wrong, it would have been very unfunny to be doing that. And that's why I think some people didn't last the course and left or cracked up. Then one began to feel that, right, well, you know, one's got a sort of career here. And then, of course, boom, came the war. There were two of us, and by then a senior dealer, a chap called Len King, and myself, and we were on a princely salary of $250 a year, which is better because I think I started off at 28 and 10 pence a week. But as I lived at home, that was, and your lunch and allowance was 11 pence for roast beef and all the trimmings, threepence for a cup of coffee, twopence tipping in the summer, a dashing strawberry flan for fourpence, and still had enough to have a pint of beer in there. Mm-hmm.
Were there any other perks? Did you get bonuses?
There were bonuses, yes. Profit sharing was, of course, only among the partners. So then, 39, I went off to Thames Haven, where the City of London Yeomanry were some very adequate guns guarding the fuel dumps.
Well, that's you describe that in the later. In the interview that we've already done. If we can go back again and review the history of the firm during the 1930s, did it continue to stay more or less typical of most jobbing firms? Was it involved in any big deals?
From 30s, the big deal was the Morris one.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I wasn't directly involved in that because Strawn and I were running the other books. Well, most of the other dealers were on the Morris issue.
Mm. How did it come about that Biscuit Bishop were involved?
Like all things, a certain amount of good fortune at attending ability. We were quite large in the motor market, and Nuffield and Morris had for a long time resisted a lot of influential merchants.